You should have gotten today four handouts. One of them is rather trivial, the other are fine. Let me just say at the outset, too, that of these handouts, particularly as we discuss Song of Songs, I do not anticipate necessarily that you'll have sufficient room to write notes on this handout. I was trying to get it all on one page, but that means that we are going to go on at some greater length in some places than you might be able to record notes. So you might bear that in mind and treat it more or less as a table of contents or an outline rather than a fill-in-the-blanks sheet. Okay, we're just waiting one more minute for people to get settled. I was a little tardy getting the pages up there, so it takes people a while to grab them. Let me also say we need to do several things tonight. We're going to deal with Song of Songs. We're going to deal with Lamentations more briefly. We're going to spend more time on Song of Songs. I just got excited about Song of Songs, so spend more time on that and a little more briefly on Lamentations. Perhaps it's not the best thing in the world to have Lamentations be the last book you cover right before the final exam, but there you have it. That's the way the course is laid out. It's not my fault. Nothing's my fault. The other things we need to do today is talk a little bit about the final so you know sort of what to expect, although I can't guarantee. I may even give you a few sample questions. And I'm hoping that some of you recalled what I said last week, encouraging you to bring sample questions. Now, obviously, I don't want dozens of them from each of you, but if you have one or two what you regard as good exam questions, I would love to filch through them and see them, and I may include them, no guarantees of that either, but if I do manage to include them, then those would be two that you should get right, you know, particularly if you give me the answer with the question. Now, did anyone do that? Very good. Michelle did. You did. All right. Darlene, thank you. Anyone else? We're going to have two questions on the... No, I have dozens of questions already prepared. I'm just interested. You may even during a break think, now, if I were making out this test, this is the kind of question I would ask. Now, let me just also add, they need to be objective type questions. Unfortunately, you know, in order to get that kind of turnaround on grading in a class this size, I cannot have you write at length on very thoughtful questions. So I try to construct some thoughtful, objective questions. And so that's what I'm looking for if you decide to give me some of that. Okay? Well, maybe tonight, again, in the interest of time, since we do have... Oh, and the last thing we need to do is, don't let me forget, I have course evaluations which I need to circulate in the last 10 minutes or so. So when you're tired and irritable, that's when I want you to do them. And I will remind you, you know, speak the truth in love. Be honest. I need to learn. This is the first time I've taught this course to an MA class, which has caused some good deal of consternation on my part, because a lot of things I do at the MDiv level I dropped out, and it was sometimes tough to scramble and know exactly what to do in here. So I am looking for good, positive suggestions. Putting your name on the evaluations is optional. I will not be looking at your names so that I will not hold prejudice against you as I grade your final. But as Dr. Collins says, you know, if you have some criticism that is worth speaking, you know, it might be worth putting your name so that I can talk to you about it. It's difficult for a teacher to get a particularly sharp criticism and not be able to talk to that person about it. It's sort of like getting blindsided and you didn't see who hit you and you can't really deal with it. Okay, so if you have mostly praises, that's fine, and you don't need to sign your name because I won't come asking for more. But if you do have constructive criticism, I keep emphasizing constructive, you know, I would encourage you not to be afraid to put your name down. I will not bear grudges. I'm not that kind of person. And perhaps we could talk about it. Perhaps I could learn more from you, get some suggestions as to how to improve. So again, it's optional, and I want to remind you of that. But if you have the guts, put your name on it, okay? Otherwise, it's kind of like an anonymous letter. Good. Well, we'll come back to that later on today, shortly after the Lamentations. But why don't we begin this evening just by reading the memory verse from last week. Notice that I'm falling behind on my memory work. Reading the memory verse from last week and also from this week, week 13. The last memory verse was Ecclesiastes 3:11, and I won't ask you to repeat this with me. I'll just read it to us, and we can reflect briefly on it. He has made everything beautiful in its time. He has also set eternity in the hearts of men, yet they cannot fathom what God has done from beginning to end. Ecclesiastes 3:11. An interesting verse reminding us of the book we looked at last week. He has indeed made everything beautiful in its time, or perhaps a better way of rendering that is everything is appropriate in its time. Even a final exam coming up is appropriate in its own way, in its time. But what particularly was interesting in this verse, and the reason I chose it, is this notion. He has also set eternity in the hearts of men, yet they cannot fathom, they cannot find out, figure out what God has done from beginning to end. It's interesting to reflect on the uniqueness of the human species. We are not satisfied with eating and sleeping and little else. We want to have goals. We want to have direction in our lives. We have this sense of eternity, and so we strive to understand, and yet there's much in life that continues to baffle us. We can be thankful that God understands, and we know Him. And even when He appears to us in the most dramatic form, as He did to Job, He doesn't necessarily give us answers. He just gives us a sense of His presence. And that is perhaps also a nice transition to Lamentations 3:19, where we read of one whose heart is downcast within him. And he says this, "I remember my affliction and my wandering, the bitterness and the gall. I well remember them, and my soul is downcast within me. Yet this I call to mind, and therefore I have hope. Because of the Lord's great love, we are not consumed. For His compassions never fail. They are new every morning. Great is Your faithfulness. I say to myself, the Lord is my portion, therefore I will wait for Him." Old Testament scholars often debate what is the middle, what is the center. And it's always a German debate, so they talk about das Mitte. What is the das Mitte, or the middle punkt, the middle point? What is the core of the Old Testament? And a lot of, you know, is it promise, fulfillment? Is it covenant? What is it? Doug Stewart, one of my favorite Old Testament professors when I was in seminary, said he believes the center of the Old Testament is the faithfulness of God. And that would perhaps not be a bad center for the entire Bible. Because of the Lord's great love, we are not consumed. For His compassions never fail. They are new every morning. Great is Your faithfulness. Therefore, I say to myself, the Lord is my portion. Therefore, I will wait for Him. Even in the midst of the catastrophe that this individual writing the book of Lamentations had experienced, he could yet turn his mind. Though his heart was downcast within him, yet even in his, can we call it depression, he could turn to God and remember that God's great love has prevented us from being consumed. His compassions never fail. They are new every morning. That is an encouragement to me. I hope that will be an encouragement to you even as you face the next week and the many things that we face in life on a weekly basis, to know that God is faithful. And though we are faithless, yet He remains faithful, for He cannot deny Himself, and He's faithful to us because His Spirit indwells us. And so we can count on that. Let's pray and thank Him for it. Our Father God, we do thank You that among Your many attributes, faithfulness looms large. We thank You, too, that as we learn of Your faithfulness, we are also encouraged to reflect in our own lives that particular attribute in our relationships with one another. I pray, Father, that as we consider tonight the book of Song of Solomon, and as we move on to consider the book of Lamentations, I pray that Your Spirit would be here with us, that You would be faithful to us, that You would help us in our weakness, that You would open our blind eyes, and that You would open our ears, that we may hear and learn from Your Word what You would teach us. Lord, we thank You again for the breadth and depth of Your Word. We thank You that it is not a pamphlet that You gave us, but You gave us a book that is worthy of a lifetime and more of study. And You gave us a book that we cannot understand apart from Your Spirit. So we invoke His presence with us tonight. Lord, I pray for each person in this class. I thank You for them, and I pray that You would be with each one, meeting the needs that are felt and the needs that perhaps are not even felt. Lord, we depend on Your compassions being new every morning. We thank You for that. In Jesus' name, amen. Okay, well, let's begin with the Song of Songs. No, let's begin with a question. Dave? Right. Yeah, the word is about what it sounds like in English. In other words, that is my lot. That is my inheritance. That's what I have. That's my possession. Maybe we would think the Lord is... possession sounds like we have ownership of God. And yet it's really talking about what is it that I have that I can hold on to. The end of Psalm 73, which I'm not sure I can quote. I learned it in German, actually. We learned a little song in German, and so I can try to think of how to translate that in English. May mind and body fail me, but the Lord is my... Maybe I should look it up so I don't mess this up. Psalm 73 at the end says something very similar. And this is a nice inclusio, you know, to go back to the Psalms here right at the end. This is all planned. Thank you for asking, Dave. In verse 25 of Psalm 73, "Whom have I in heaven but you? And earth has nothing I desire besides you. My flesh and my heart may fail, but God is the strength of my heart and my portion forever." Again, thinking of the notion of biblical parallelism and how there is some advance, some intensification, but nevertheless, one line can be interpretive of the other. I think the notion that the psalmist is talking about what he desires on earth, and he says, "My flesh and my heart," in other words, my body and even my mind may fail me. Heart, remember, in Hebrew also connotes the cognitive capacity, the mind. "My flesh and my heart may fail, but God is the strength of my heart and my portion forever." So again, back to that single-minded focus of the Psalms, and since the Psalms are the theology of the Bible in microcosm, also the theology of the Bible, God is to be front and center in our understandings, in our desires, in what life is all about, in our purpose. Well, let's move to the Song of Songs. And I know I say this from week to week, you know, this is one of my favorite books in the Bible. And this is, again, one of my favorite books. It's an intriguing book. Comes right after the book of Ecclesiastes. It is counted among the wisdom books. It is, however, one of the more difficult books in the Bible. You may have discovered this in reading it and trying to figure out just what, in fact, the Song of Songs is even talking about. And the clarity is not usually gained by reading what others think. I hope you enjoyed Barry Webb's article. I think that is one of the more helpful short pieces that I have read. I want to suggest, you know, we'll talk a little bit about his interpretation. I want to suggest an alternative that is represented in the recent commentary by Duane Garrett, this in the New American Commentary series. Again, I've mentioned this book before, but this is not a lengthy commentary, but very insightful, in my view. So we'll talk some about his interpretation. I will also be alluding tonight to this very fine book by Dan Allender and Tremper Longman, Intimate Allies. If you are looking for summer reading, I might suggest this book, particularly if you're married or contemplating marriage or would entertain the thought of marriage should the opportunity arise, or are entertaining the notion of developing good and helpful relationships with your friends. If you're not one of those, then don't read this book. If you are, you might want to read it this summer. Now, what if different commentators said about the Song of Songs? And this is all squeezed in before we get to point one in your outline. Okay, so I'm just going to give you a sampling of opinions about the book. Lloyd Carr, whom I had the privilege of listening to in Sunday school when I was in seminary up in Gordon-Conwell, up in the Boston area, he, believe it or not, he taught a long-term Sunday school class on Song of Songs. He then subsequently wrote the Tyndale Old Testament commentary to this particular book. But I dare say I heard more weeks on the Song of Songs than most anyone in this room will have ever heard. It's a great book. It needs to be taught more. He says, "Among the books of the Bible, the Song of Songs is one of the smallest, most difficult, yet one of the most popular with both Jews and Christians." Andrew Hill, who is an Old Testament professor up at Wheaton College, says, "No single book of the Old Testament has proved more perplexing for biblical interpreters than the Song of Songs." Or as another Old Testament scholar, a German Old Testament scholar, puts it, "The history of the interpretation of the Song of Solomon is no feather in the cap of biblical exegesis." And Duane Garrett says, "No other book of the Bible, except perhaps the book of Revelation, suffers under so many radically different interpretations as the Song of Songs." Now, a major interpretive difficulty revolves around the question of just what kind of literature is the Song of Songs? What is it we're looking for, looking at when we're reading this book? What was your impression as you read it? What did it strike you as? If you had to say, this is such and such kind of book, what would it be? Poetry, okay, that was safe. Poetry. Can we put an adjective in front of that? Dramatic poetry. Okay, now that leans in the direction of one of the very popular interpretations, dramatic poetry. does seem to have some aspects of drama. Romanticism, okay, we're getting close. Yeah, romanticism. It's romantic poetry, in perhaps not a technical sense, but in a general sense, certainly. How about love poetry? Can we go with that for starters? A straightforward reading of the book suggests that this is a love poem, either a unified love poem or perhaps a collection of love poems. An anthology is one popular view. Well, if it is love poetry, pure and simple, then I would suggest that this song may provide an extremely important point of contact with our own society and with ourselves, inasmuch as confusion reigns in the area of love and sexuality and marriage probably about as much as anywhere else. I received just this week, actually I guess it was sent on May 1st, but I'm so busy at the moment I'm not always collecting my email on a daily basis. I received over email a missive from a man named Douglas Weiss, who's a Christian counselor. I don't know him. He apparently sent this out to a bunch of ordained people, a bunch of pastors. And it was four free lessons on working with people who are suffering under sexual compulsion or sexual addiction. Now that's, you guys who are counseling and counselors probably hear a great deal about that. That's a term that I had not heard until about 10 years ago. The notion of sexual addiction. I knew of sexual immorality and sexual problems and such, but sexual addiction was something that was kind of new to me. But it's very real and very present in our society today. And yet in this book, the Song of Songs, a natural reading would lead us to assume that this is a remarkably sensuous treatment of sexuality. Sexuality being one of the more confusing and more confused areas of human experience. In their book, Intimate Allies, Allender and Longman say this. They say sexuality is an area of significant struggle. Understated, of course. And then they go on, it is the one marriage component most influenced by factors as diverse as sexual abuse, past immorality, family influences, relational tensions, fear of performance, body image, and physical exhaustion. And add to that list the cultural issues of sexual obsession and idolatry, which contrast with the church's history of ambivalence. Our society seems to be enthralled with the idea of sexuality and yet has very little understanding of it. The church, on the other hand, has an ambivalent attitude, or it seems to have an ambivalent attitude. And yet the Bible seems anything but ambivalent if, in fact, this is a love poem in celebration of love between a man and a woman, erotic love, physical love. Now, we'll talk more about that. Well, this raises the issue of how indeed this book was canonized. How did it get into the canon? And so I want to talk just briefly about, we're now to point one on the outline. I want to talk briefly about authorship and date. And again, I mean briefly because I want to get to the heart of this book fairly quickly. As with the other books we've looked at, there is a moderate consensus that the book is not from Solomon, even though it is called Solomon's Most Excellent Song, or the Song of Songs of Solomon. Now, how can that be? I mean, if you believe the Bible and it says it's a Song of Songs of Solomon, why would you not necessarily assume that this is Solomonic in origin, in authorship? Well, again, I have to introduce a little bit of Hebrew. What is translated of Solomon could just as well be translated to, for, or in the style of Solomon. Okay, so it's not necessarily an ascription of authorship, although most of the time when it's used, for instance, in the superscriptions to the Psalms, or I would say possibly in this context, the most natural reading is to read it as an ascription of authorship. So I just mentioned the general consensus, a modest general consensus at this point, is not in favor of Solomonic authorship of the book, but I don't think we should be overly swayed by that. The major arguments against Solomonic authorship are linguistic arguments, and as we saw in our discussion of the book of Ecclesiastes and such, these linguistic arguments are remarkably tenuous. They're not very strong. So let's don't get carried away with them. What about Solomonic authorship? Are there evidences that it might be Solomonic, at least that's a viable option? Well, this phrase that I just mentioned, for or by Solomon, le Shalomo, and the name Solomon, indeed, occurs seven times in the book. Now, again, we don't know precisely or at least at this stage in our discussion, we're not saying how we should understand Solomon's presence. Is he a member of a drama, of a participant in a three-part drama, perhaps? Is he symbolic? Does he stand as a symbol for the glory, kingly glory of the groom? We'll see how we might want to lean as we move on. Nevertheless, the book does begin the Song of Songs, Le Shlomo, of Solomon. And that is suggestive, at least, of Solomonic authorship. Furthermore, numerous luxury items are mentioned throughout the book. There's a great awareness of the kinds of items, spices and plants and so forth, that would have been most prevalent in a royal context, or at least in a wealthy context. There is also, another point, there is also extensive geographical knowledge of cities in the what later became the Northern Kingdom, in the north, as well as in the south. And this suggests a date before the division of the kingdom. You know, the kingdom was divided upon the death of Solomon in the early years of his son Rehoboam's reign. So in 930 B.C., thereabouts, the kingdom of Israel, the unified kingdom of Israel, was divided into north and south, the north being called Israel and the south being called Judah. Well, this book shows extensive geographical knowledge of those northern cities, and they are mentioned right along with others, and that might be suggestive of a Solomonic date before the division of the kingdom. There is also reference to Tirzah in 6:4, and this as well may suggest an early date before the division of the kingdom, when Tirzah lost its prominence and significance. And then a fourth reason, another reason, is the extensive knowledge of plant and animal life. This is a very pastoral, in the pasturage sense, not in the ministerial sense, but this is a pastoral, lyrical work in which much is said about plants and animals. And it's an appropriate book, I suppose, to be reading in the springtime. And this reminds us of what is said of Solomon in 1 Kings 4, particularly verses 32 and 33, when it talks about his being able to speak about animal and plant life, the hyssop that grows out of the wall, and so forth. His apparent knowledge of flora and fauna was quite extensive. And that is certainly true of the author of this book. He knows whereof he speaks. He is something of a naturalist in terms of the extensive vocabulary he uses. Now, there are more extensive discussions of this particular question. I don't want us to pause over it too long. Hassel Bullock, in his introduction to the Songs and Wisdom of Israel, a Moody Press publication, I believe, has an extensive discussion on pages 238 to 241. And he leans in favor of Solomonic authorship, although he has one reservation based on the fact that Solomon does not seem to appear in the best possible light in the book. That's his viewpoint. I don't know, when you were reading the book, did you get the impression that Solomon was in any way portrayed in a somewhat negative light? I don't think that you would read that unless you had been introduced to the so-called three-party dramatic view, which we will talk about. A three-party view involving a simple country maiden, her true love, the shepherd, the rustic shepherd, and then the intrusive king, who is simply adding to his harem. Well, if that's the Solomon that we're talking about in this book, then we come predisposed to see him in a negative light. And those who do read it that way find his poetry to be lacking in sincerity and in genuineness and such. But it's hard to know how much of that is really in the text and how much of that is in the theory brought to the text that causes us to read it in that way. So this whole notion that Solomon is portrayed in negative light and that might tell against his authorship depends on how you interpret the book. And it's quite possible that Solomon, as I sort of suggested earlier, that Solomon, as with so many other things in the book, is used metaphorically. He is used to stand for the king, the glorious king. And in that way is used to describe the groom who is kingly in his wedding day glory, just as a man might refer to his wife as his queen. Or his princess. That's a little condescending. I'm not your princess, you know. But often we use royal imagery as terms of endearment, and it's not a long jump to see that you could also use royal personages as metaphors, calling the groom, actually calling him, "Here comes Solomon." So glorious is He. Well, all of these kinds of questions, I'm going to leave that the question of authorship a little bit hanging, although I guess the bottom line for me is I'm not convinced that there are any real barriers to the view that Solomon is the author of this book. And were I fully convinced that it makes that claim, then of course I would embrace that view wholeheartedly. It seems to make that claim, but I wouldn't want to go beyond that in terms of certainty. Now, but these whole questions, as I mentioned already, hinge on interpretive questions. And so we want to move on to the next point on the outline, interpretive approaches to the Song of Songs. And again, though on your handout this takes up a large portion of the page, we want to move with some dispatch through them because we're going to spend more time when we get down to key verses and questions. And I want to have some discussion about those key verses that I've highlighted there, but also other things that came to your mind as you read this book, which doesn't mean I'm going to race through these. We are going to talk about them. These are some of the typical interpretations that have been attempted with this particular book. The first is the allegorical interpretation. You probably have some notion of what allegory means. Does anyone want to attempt a definition for allegory? You don't have to give me a dictionary definition, but what do you think of when you say, oh, he's being allegorical, or he's engaging in allegorical interpretation? Beth? Okay, yeah, the story is not really about itself. It's about something else. And what really distinguishes an allegory is that multiple elements in the story each have their correspondent in some other, usually higher reality that is being described in allegorical fashion. The word comes from two Greek words, allos, which means other, and agorio, which means to speak or to proclaim. So it's speaking about something else than what appears on the surface. And this mode of interpreting the Song of Songs was popular in Hellenistic Judaism and early Christianity. And some believe that was preferred, although I'm not sure. Some even would suggest that it was the allegorical interpretation of this book that enabled it to get into the canon. That if those recognizing authoritative books had realized that this was love poetry, that they would have been reticent to allow it in. I don't buy that. And others of far greater stature than I, such as Brevard Childs, also doesn't buy that. So I wouldn't go in that direction. But we do need to be aware that this book has often been interpreted in that fashion. For instance, the Jews have seen, in Jewish interpreters have seen in this book, symbolized in the two lovers, God and Israel. And it is true that God sometimes describes Old Testament Israel, the people of God in the Old Testament, as His bride, often His unfaithful wife. But it would be astonishing this kind of overtly sexual imagery were used in that allegorical fashion to represent God and His people. Christian interpreters have seen, as you might anticipate, the groom being Christ and the church being the bride of Christ. Some Roman Catholic interpreters have even seen in some, I would need to figure out how this would work, but have seen the Virgin Mary as the bride. Probably not the bride of Christ, but I think you'd have to say the mother of Christ, the bride of God. I don't know exactly how that would work. If this is the proper interpretation, which I highly doubt, it's certainly not clearly indicated anywhere in the text. We never have an interpretive key given. And it's perhaps significant that in the New Testament, there's never a harking back to the Song of Songs in this fashion, you know, using it allegorically in the New Testament. In the Targums, which was the Aramaic translation of the Old Testament that would be read in synagogue service, this song is interpreted in various allegorical ways. For instance, chapter 1, verses 2 to 4, you know, when it begins, "Let him kiss me with the kisses of his mouth, for your love is more delightful than wine." And then in verse 4, "Take me away with you, let us hurry, let the king bring me into his chambers." In the Targum, in the Aramaic translation of this particular passage, the interpretation is as a reference to the Exodus. "Take me away with you, let us hurry." You can kind of see how in a flight of fancy they may have happened upon that. God takes Israel away from Egypt and into God's own chambers, that is, the promised land. Well, I don't see much conviction on any of your faces, so I'm pleased with that. I don't think this is probably the way to go either. Now, these are some ancient allegorical interpretations. I've run across a more recent one. In fact, a book published in 1989 by a fellow named Louis Stadelman. If I understand it correctly, is also in this allegorical mode. The title of his book is Love and Politics, A New Commentary on the Song of Songs. And the gist of the book seems to be this, that what you have in the Song of Songs is not a love poem per se, but an allegory. It stands for something else. And in fact, in the words of the jacket of the book, this is a carefully disguised program for bringing back the royal family of David to rule in Jerusalem after the exile in 587 to 540, despite the Persian Empire's control of the land. Bingo. That certainly convinced me. No, I don't want to show disrespect to a book that I haven't read thoroughly, but this is an example, I think, of allegorical, perhaps allegorical interpretation, where he's saying it sounds like it's about a man and a woman in love, but really it's about two kingdoms, and the word, it's cast in such a way that it would not have been readily understood by the Persian powers that be. They wouldn't have known what was, you know, the suggestions that were actually being made about uniting the kingdoms, bringing back the Davidic family. Well, there are strange things in the world of biblical scholarship, and you can find them particularly about this very challenging book. Well, that's allegorical interpretation, ancient and modern. A second type of interpretation might be deemed or called typological, which is a little bit akin to allegory, but also different. Typological interpretation depends on correspondence between two historical events, or at least two real events. It's not just a story that's made up to represent something else, but something that happened in history is a foreshadowing of something else that will happen later. So there's a correspondence, and then there's usually escalation. The reality foreshadowed is of a higher order than the initial historical event. Now, an exponent of this particular view, conservative exponent, would be Franz Delitzsch, who sees Solomon in this song as a type of Christ and the bride as a type of the church. But he's not saying this is just an allegory written about Christ and the church. He's saying, oh yeah, it could be, if I understand him correctly, this could be love between a man and a woman, but there's a higher reality that is the real purpose of the book, and that is to describe Christ and the church. Now, Lloyd Carr's assessment of this, with which I would agree, is that the book may serve to illustrate something about the love relationship between Christ and his church, but that's not the purpose of the book. Barry Webb moves in that direction too, if you noticed at the end of the essay that you read for this week. At the end, he does say, yeah, we can learn something theologically from this book, from the Song of Songs, about the love of God for his people, and about Edenic love, the love of Eden, and it's, you know, looking back to Eden, looking forward to heaven. We can learn about what love is supposed to be like. We'll flesh that out a little bit more in just a minute. So maybe there's something here we need to grab hold of, but I don't think the typological approach is the right one. Then there is the mythical cultic approach, and this really gets fairly wild and in numerous variations. In brief summary, the view is that the erotic literature of the fertility cults, Babylonian fertility cults, and I won't give you details of the Tammuz and the Baal cults and so forth, but the erotic literature of these fertility cults is what is actually taken up and transformed here. A man by the name of T.J. Meek came to the conclusion that the Song of Songs was an expurgated, that means a purified, a cleaned up version of a Canaanite fertility cult hymnic material. It's an awkward sentence, but that was his view, that what you had was some rather strange fertility cultic material that has now been cleaned up and incorporated into Scripture. Well, again, I'm not doing justice to the view to summarize it quite that briefly, but let me just say, in the interest of getting to the heart of the book, I wouldn't go that direction either. But you need to know it's out there, and you need to know that certain major, major commentaries take that approach. And so you may buy a commentary, a very good commentary in a good series, and you might begin to scratch your head, what in the world is going on here? So you need to know that some people approach it from that particular angle. Now, another approach that does dawn on many people is what might be called a historical approach. And this is simply the view that what we have here is an actual account of a romantic affair from the life of Solomon. There are some interpreters who think, well, this is perhaps Solomon early in the construction of his harem, when his love was less jaded, But, you know, if you read in the book, what was the reference that talked about the number of his wives already? I think there were something like 60 wives already. So it wasn't all that early in his love life. Some have even suggested that maybe Solomon, what we have here is Solomon's failed attempt to woo Abishag, the Shunammite. Remember Abishag, the Shunammite? Now, Shunam is a place name that is known. Shulamite is not. But some have said, well, the transposition of an L and an N in Hebrew is a possibility. They are both liquid letters. I could probably think of an English example if I thought long and hard about it. The way in which N legal became illegal. You know, the N turned into an L. I'm sure we're all concerned with that. But some have suggested, you know, Solomon, upon David's death, you know, they had searched the whole land to find the most beautiful young virgin in the territory, and David did not know her. And so some say, well, maybe this is a love song between Solomon and Abishag, who ultimately returns to her shepherd lover, the real man that she cares for, abandoning Solomon. Well, this would make good television and would be fun, but I'm not sure that there's enough there to really go with that. The final view, and obviously I've reserved the one that I think is more in the right direction for last, is the view that takes it at face value. This appears to be the celebration of human love, the love between a man and a woman. We want to circumscribe it in all the right ways, but it does seem to be a love song or love songs. This is, in fact, the dominant contemporary theory and probably the right one. It should not surprise us that the Bible, with its strong emphasis on the sanctity of human love within the marriage relationship, should contain some such collection, or either love song or collection of love songs. Something to provide instruction to us. Something to indicate to us that, yes, that is right and that is good. The delight in the physical aspects of love is good and right in the right and good contexts. Finding the physical as well as emotional love relationship depicted in the Bible in such rich and graphic, if not sometimes rather strange and foreign terms, does come as something of a shock to Western ears. But we must acknowledge that, as one writer has put it, that the images we read in this song are vivid, but not lurid. That's L-U-R-I-D. The open honesty of their approach may put them a cut above the innuendo sometimes found in our contemporary Western cultures. And, you know, if you're a media person, which I don't have time to be at the moment, but if you occasionally do see the media, watch television or go to many movies or whatever, you realize that our culture is not only fraught with innuendo, but we're far beyond that. And the kind of sexual discourse that we have in our culture is not mere innuendo. It's crass and misdirected. And so though we're sometimes taken aback by what we think we're hearing in this song, it's done in a very high style, a sophisticated style that enables us to be drawn in by the power and to come to some sense of the power of human physical attraction between a man and a woman without it becoming so literal and obvious and visual that it becomes almost pornographic. Okay, that is avoided. Leland Ryken says, puts it better than I just did. He says, the song is, quote, a notable example of how one love poet solved the problem of depicting romantic sexual love in literature. On the one hand, the poet avoids the pitfalls of allowing the love to evaporate into an abstraction by continually making physical attractiveness the main ingredient of the romantic relationship. On the other hand, the poet avoids pornography by consistently choosing to portray the sexual love that is his subject through the use of symbolism. The result is that we get the strong impression of the sexual attractiveness of the lovers and the value of their physical love without being asked to picture the physical details of their relationship. And I think in that sense it's brilliant, because if you've read the book, perhaps if you can recall, you know, when you initially began to read the book, when you read it for the first few times before becoming quite so familiar with it, it was strangely alluring, and you were wondering, what does that mean? I know that means something, but you weren't exactly sure what. But it gave you the right sense of the power of love. Love is as strong as death, without necessarily being a sex manual, as it were. complete with charts and graphic descriptions and medical terms. Rather, it uses these romantic terms, these pastoral terms, referring to, as I've handed out this rather strange image, referring to the beauty, for instance, of the woman in metaphoric ways that astonish us if we're literalists. Let me cast this on the board here just to delight our eyes for a moment. I didn't warn you, Vicky. I hope you can maybe capture this. This is a little fuzzy, pretty much impossible to see at the moment. It's a little fuzzy and part of it's cut off, but the top says, "The Song of Solomon Illustrated," and then the subtitle is, "For Our Literalist Friends." If you have a friend who is incapable of grasping metaphor, you might want to show them this picture and say, you know, we have to take language on its own terms, and language is metaphoric, is symbolic. And so what you have here is the rather beautiful description of the bride by the groom or by the husband, literally portrayed. You just take what he says, apply the literal hermeneutic, and this is what you come up with, and he still wants to marry her. Unbelievable. "How beautiful you are, my darling, how beautiful you are. Your eyes are like doves behind your veil. Your hair is like a flock of goats." Now, what does that mean? Your hair is like a flock of goats. Now, I've had some acquaintance with goats, and I have determined that most goats are dusty and some are even flea-ridden. Now, is that what he's saying? Your hair is like a flock of goats. No, I don't think so. What might he be talking about? Sorry? Soft? But why a flock of goats? Why not just a goat? Or why not a rabbit, for that matter? Wavy hair? Okay. Goats have wavy hair? Yeah, if you... Doesn't it say something like a flock of goats descending? Oh, probably has long hair. But a flock, it talks about flock of goats descending the hills of, I can't remember exactly, the hills of Mount Gilead. Okay? So if you think, if put yourself, you know, on a trip to Israel, you're looking across the valley and you see a flock of goats descending the Mount Gilead. Now, what does that look like? Yeah. Probably black goats, black wavy hair undulating down, you know, that you see the movement, you see the, they had body, you know, don't hate me because I'm beautiful, because my hair's so beautiful. He's using a metaphor, but he's only wanting to highlight one aspect of his beloved. He's not really saying, you know, that your hair has hoofs in it, little hard bits or fleas or dust. No, he's just saying, when I see your hair undulating down your landscape, it reminds me of a flock of goats with all that movement and undulation and beauty on a hillside. And, you know, if you take that general approach, you can begin to figure out, your teeth are like a flock of newly shorn ewes. Well, again, you know, the hair is only short. You know, I don't think so. You know, I think he's talking about, your teeth are very white. You know, like a freshly shorn sheep may be very white. Your lips are like a scarlet thread. Your temples are like a slice of pomegranate. You know, lots of seeds and oozing. I don't, you know, we have to be careful with this. But once we understand that, your two breasts are like two fawns, tender, graceful, beautiful to see. Those kinds of things are involved there. And I won't get ludicrous with that one. But you see the point, okay? Not to be taken literally, but we're to try to strive to understand what is the major point of comparison. And sometimes we can succeed, sometimes it's more difficult. There we go. So you can put that little picture in your files and use it with your literalist friends. Okay. Now, so remember, one point of comparison, that's the emphasis in this kind of literature. Let me give you one example from an Arabian wedding song. Often you can learn something from comparative literature. It's not the Bible, but it comes from a similar culture, and so you can learn some things from it. This is from an Arabian wedding song that was, in fact, recorded by a fellow named Wettstein that I'll mention in just a minute, who tried to argue that this Song of Songs is from an actual wedding ceremony based on what he had witnessed in his own living among the Syrian people. But these are lines from an Arabian wedding ceremony. "O fair one," I don't know why this person was speaking King James English, but for some reason he's thine attractions. This would be Wettstein's translation, of course. "O fair one, thine attractions I am never able to relate, and only the few will I describe which my eyes permit me to see. Her head is like the crystal goblet. Her hair is like the black night. Her hair is like the seven nights. The like are not in the whole year. In waves it moves hither and thither, like the rope of her who draws water. Okay? Now, you know, if we take that absolutely literally, we might not be all that complimented, but I think a person from that culture understands the point he's making, like a crystal goblet. Her head is like a crystal goblet. You know, you don't think, well, is it full or empty? You know, you don't start asking, is it half full? To some people, it's half full. No, it's a priceless object. It's priceless. It's beautiful. It's well crafted. Her hair is like the black night. Her hair is like the seven nights. The like are not in the whole year. The seven darkest nights, you know, when the moon doesn't shine, so black is her hair. And that's beautiful. In waves it moves hither and thither, like a rope of her who draws water. Okay, it's not dripping. It's not covered with algae, you know, but you get that sense, again, the sense of undulation. That must have been particularly attractive to these Near Easterners or Middle Easterners. So you get the impression of how to interpret this poetry as we go through it. Now, before we take a break, I want to just mention Wettstein's theory. And then after the break, we'll come back and look at, we're still under literal, by the way, we'll look at the nature of this poem as a love poem. Whether it's a collection, whether it's a unified love poem, whether there's a dream sequence and such. We'll do that just after the break. But before we go, let me mention the one other theory, and that is that this is an actual liturgy from a wedding ceremony. A fellow named J.G. Wettstein came up with what has been come to be called the threshing board theory. And you think, well, why in the world would something be called a threshing board theory? He was writing, by the way, back in the 19th century. Well, he lived in Syria, and he noted certain elements of the Syrian wedding ceremonies that he witnessed while he was living there in Damascus. And in particular, the bride and the groom would be placed on a threshing sledge, a threshing board, and they would be elevated above the crowds, and then they would be proclaimed king and queen. I guess it's kind of like king and queen of the prom. You know, it's your night to be king and queen. Well, it was their wedding. And so, of course, the groom became the king, the bride became the queen, and during this wedding ceremony, called a watsif is the term given, a song praising the beauty and bodily perfection of the two would be sung. And this was a rote thing. I mean, this was a standard thing. You didn't qualify. They're going to sing the song, whether, in fact, you're fully deserving of it or not, I suppose. That's just the way it was done. Now, this theory, as interesting in some ways as it is, and there are some things it does seem that a wedding is at the center of this book in some way, of Song of Songs. This theory has not been broadly accepted, or certainly not unanimously accepted, because it does require that many modifications be made to the text to make it work. And whenever, you know, if there's a theory that requires us to change the text about a bit, then we want to reserve judgment and try something else. And that is what we will try after a break. We will look at particularly Barry Webb's and also Dwayne Garrett's reading of this book, and then our own reading and have some discussion of it. So if you would come back when the big hand reaches the one, that is in 10 minutes. So take a 10-minute break.